Giant Steel and Aluminum Company versus Michael Sepcich and Kathy Loss.
May it please the court, Mr. Wright will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the court, I'd like to talk about two issues today. What do you do when there's no evidence of the number the jury found for damages? And what do you do when a party deliberately introduces prejudicial evidence that this court and the legislature has cautioned against? What should be the remedy? First, the damages issue. This court has held in Murdoch, Formosa, and other cases, including Gullo and 3M, that a no-evidence challenge can be made to the amount of damages, that when there is no evidence to support the amount of damages found, but there is some evidence of some damage, then a remand is appropriate. The cases have applied that to a number of different kinds of damages, including past medical, which was an issue in the Murdoch case. What we have here are three kinds of damages that we are talking about today: past medical, future medical, and lost earning capacity. All of those are pecuniary damages. They are all economic damages as defined by the legislature in Chapter 41 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. They should all be treated as subject to the same kinds of no-evidence attacks that this court has sustained in the cases that I've mentioned. Now, the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals properly held that there was no evidence to support the past medical damage. But then they rendered judgment on a lower amount that was not established as a matter of law by the record. And they had no power to do that. They usurped the jury's function in doing that rather than remanding for trial, at least on that issue. And the question, of course, would come to mind, gee, do we have to send a case back for a new trial for a $6,000 error? Well, that issue is not going to be a problem in this case because we don't have just a $6,000 error. We have an error in the future medical. I know the court is well aware of the record. The future medicals in this case consist mostly of testimony from a psychologist who happened, not coincidentally, to run a program in Houston that his program might be of benefit to the plaintiff. Now, whether that's evidence of anything is questionable, but even if you say, well, that's some evidence that this program was medically necessary, which he never...
What if we agreed with you on all these, their conditional waiver, and said, okay, if you agree with them, just forget it. We'll drop all those.
Well, that conditional waiver, an attempt to bargain with the court, in our view, is not effective because of the infection of the whole case by this evidence of wealth. And that's, you know, a point that I'll develop now if Your Honor wishes.
But before you, just before you leave the point, how is the rendition of the lower number any different in effect from a remittitor if the judgment creditor doesn't object?
Well, it's not different in effect, but the remedy is not available. A remittitor is available where there is some evidence, but factually insufficient evidence to support the award. Where there's no evidence to support the number at all, I don't believe a remittitor is appropriate. And whether this court can even do a remittitor is a question that was left open in the the name will come to me, but a case about 20 years ago.
But it doesn't seem to make much sense,
Redmond,
to have a remittitor, to allow a remittitor procedure for factually insufficient evidence but not for legally insufficient evidence.
Well, the question is whether if there's no evidence at all to support the number, which is easier to see in the pecuniary loss area where there are measures of damage that are available.
We'll assume the past medicals area and then answer the question.
Well, the past medical, if the Court of Appeals had said, well, we will remit this, they cannot do that because they said there's no evidence of it. Had they held and had the fact been that there was factually insufficient but legally sufficient evidence of the amount awarded, then they could have suggested a remittitor, and the other side could have accepted that or not. So, but the evidence infects all of these areas, and let me go to that. This is not a case where some evidence just slipped out, where some witness was on the stand and accidentally said something. This is deposition testimony. It's in writing. Everybody knows what it says. They know what the question is. They know what the answer is. And they go up to the judge, and the plaintiffs say, "Judge, we are entitled to introduce this evidence of gross sales of $1.9 billion last year for the purpose of showing that the defendant is not a mom-and-pop operation." Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that the defendant has a lot of money and can well afford whatever the jury wants to award.
Is it any different if, say, Reliance, your client attempted to show that this plaintiff was wealthy or perhaps purchased a Suburban or had a new home? How's that any different?
Well, I would say two things about that. First of all, the trial judge sustained the plaintiff's objection to the question about the new Suburban.
Let's say he didn't.
Well, you know, then you'd have to ask, well, which came first? I mean, you know, to some extent, the defense lawyer has to have a right to try to fight back when the judge has done this. So I don't think they're offsetting in any regard. Nobody was asking for money to be awarded against the plaintiff. And there was the necessity of having some evidence about her earnings because she's making a claim for lost earning capacity, which normally is proved by a history of earnings. But in this case,
set the stage in the context for how this information got elicited and known to the jury. I'm sort of confused on that.
All right. Well, of course, the corporate rep's deposition had been taken prior to trial. The question was asked, how big of a company is Reliance Steel? And he said, well, we had $1.9 billion in sales last year, a gross sales number. And so I believe there was a motion in limine granted. At any event, the parties knew enough to go to the bench and have a bench conference about whether this evidence ought to come in. So outside the presence of the jury, our side makes the objection that this is irrelevant, and they're not even seeking punitive damages. And the judge says, you're not even seeking punitive damages. Doesn't that make this less relevant? And the plaintiff says, well, we're entitled to show that they're not a mom-and-pop operation, which nobody had argued. It had already come out that they had offices in different places and so forth. And so they want to put this in for the specific prohibited purpose of showing that the defendant is a big company. And if you look at the order of proof in the case, they start by putting Mr. Sevcik on the stand to say how the accident happened and to talk about his injuries, which fortunately were not that severe. Then they put two doctors on to talk about the severity of the plaintiff's injury, the other plaintiff, Ms. Loth. And then they put on this evidence, and by the way, the defendant is loaded. Information was not lost on this jury.
If the judge did this and later on during the course of the trial, for whatever reason, realized that he or she may have erred, would an instruction to the jury to disregard that evidence cure this problem?
I doubt it. You know, it is not as socially offensive as making a racial comment or a religious comment, but it has a similar effect. You cannot unring the bell. You can't tell the jury, oh, you heard that evidence before, please disregard it.
Oh, sure you can. There's instruction. Otherwise, instruction wouldn't be allowed for a trial court to give, disregard that.
I'm not saying the trial court can't do it. I'm just saying in this circumstance, in this evidence, you see, in the Morial case, this court specifically identified evidence of wealth as being pernicious.
I understand that.
Okay.
Don't you have to consider the totality of the statement and the totality of the trial to determine whether or not there's harm, if any?
Well, I think when somebody deliberately violates what this court said, what the legislature has said about wealth evidence, goes up and intentionally asks the court to put it in for the purpose of showing how big the defendant is, there ought to be presumed harm. I mean, there's not that many kinds of evidence that could be this incendiary in a trial to say how wealthy the defendant is.
But the sum total of what was introduced was that single deposition sentence?
Yes. And our position is you don't need to repeat $1.9 billion in order for the jury to get it. In fact, every time you ask jurors after a trial, and those of you who have been trial judges know this, one of the complaints you will get is, why did they repeat so much? We got it the first time. Well, they got this the first time.
If instead of the monetary amount, the question was, how many drivers do you have, how many buildings, what's your payload on a typical day, and that sort of thing, that gave the the clear impression that this was a very large company. Would that have been prejudicial as well?
Well, it wouldn't be nearly as prejudicial because it would be more difficult for the jury to tie that to any particular number. Yes, maybe they have a lot of drivers, but companies can have a lot of employees and still be losing money.
And so my question is, and this is before vicarious liability had been stipulated, as I understand it, that evidence came in, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there are other ways for them to have established that it's not a mom-and-pop operation?
Well, yes, they could have. They could have said you have offices in other states and, you know, and so forth. And they did put in some of that kind of evidence.
Had the defendant done anything to the jury, in front of the jury, to suggest it was a mom-and-pop operation?
No, Your Honor, there's not a thing in the record where the jury had suggested that. The defense had suggested that. He was talking about, of course, mostly talking about his driver and so forth. But, you know, there was no suggestion that the company was not, able to take care of whatever happened. But, you know, frankly,
we sort of divine or conclude with confidence that the jury's verdict turned on what you say was this improper reference?
Well, first, I think that you could make a rule that says it's presumed. When it's under these circumstances, when it's deliberate, when it's evidence, this evidence is not even admissible had they been seeking punitive damages. If you don't presume harm, you look at what happened. And if you look at the damage awards where this lady had worked for a week or who knows how long, she couldn't say, making $630 a week 10 years before the trial, and that turns into a $750,000 award for lost earning capacity with no visible means of support. And you look at the medical, the future medical, that's more than twice the number that they proved on their best day. You know the numbers are inflated.
So you're pretty confident that with a new trial that the damages a jury finds will be significantly less?
I'm confident of this. The new trial will be tried on the merits of the case if this court says that this evidence should not be and should not have been admitted. And if this court does not say that, if this court says this is harmless error, this kind of evidence is going to come in every trial because the plaintiff is going to say, well, I can argue harmless error and try to settle this on appeal for some fraction of the inflated judgment and verdict that I get. So that's the dilemma this court faces. So back to these damages for a minute. You know, this court has said in the McIver case 50 years ago that, yes, you don't need to, prove to the dollar every bit of lost earning capacity, but when you are trying to collect money on lost earning capacity from a specialized business or profession, a higher level of proof is required. That's a case both of us rely on. Well, this plaintiff was attempting to get lost earning capacity from this sewing business. She did not make any kind of level of proof about how the business would go, what kind of profit she would make, and so forth. We're criticized for talking about lost profits, but that's exactly what we believe they were trying to do. Now, you can't say that, you know, in every case of infants and so forth, that there's got to be a past earning history. But you could say, and in fact the McIver case does say, when a person has been working...
Was the jury instructed that Reliance would pay any damages assessed against its driver?
I don't believe the jury was instructed that. They just...
Just to get to Justice Willis' question again, how can we assume that this reference to the $1.9 billion entered the jury's deliberations with respect to questions that were submitted not against as to Reliance, but only as to Sam Alvarado, I think his name was.
Well, the jury was told he was an employee of the company. I think the jury is going to assume that the company is going to take care of it.
Company's name is on the top of the charge, probably, right?
Well, yes. The company's name is in the style of the case, and they heard a lot about it before that stipulation was entered into. So, you know, I don't think they had any question about who was going to pay. They knew that if it was up to Mr. Alvarado, he wouldn't have been able to have a lawyer there, probably. So,
how do you know that? How do you jump to that conclusion?
He's a truck driver. I don't think a truck driver is going to rack up enough assets in his own
business. Well, how do you know that? I mean, you're just assuming things. Why can't the jury assume that your company has $500,000 or $500 billion worth of assets.
They can assume what they like. But the problem is, are you going to let the plaintiff's lawyer go in and prove that, and prove it with improper evidence that doesn't even show net worth, but to try to inflate an idea of wealth? If these cases are going to be tried on who's got the most money, they could be tried a lot quicker because you could prove that right away. But, you know, yes, I was assuming they would figure that. Maybe that's a false assumption. But I think the jury didn't have any confusion about Reliance Steel being Mr. Alvarado's employer, and they didn't have any confusion about Reliance Steel being a big company because of this evidence that was erroneously let in.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Wright. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Holman will present argument for the respondents.
Mr. Holman, how's the admissibility of the defendant's net worth any different from allowing an insurance issue to come into a case?
It was quite different in this situation. The court, as you know, it's an abuse of discretion standard of review. And the question is whether the admission of evidence was an abuse of discretion. That's the first question. The second question is whether the whole case turned upon that admission of evidence in order to be reversible. In this case, the Reliance Steel was still a party, and the question was, why did they drive their drivers so hard? Mr. Alvarado, this was on a Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. He's driving back to San Antonio on a dead-end run after having driven 61 hours that week.
They were required to work 60 in a 40-hour week.
Correct. And the plaintiff attorney wanted to show that this was a big enough company that had the resources to provide more drivers and not to have to work their drivers so hard.
Explain that to me. That's So the argument is bigger companies can afford to be less productive than smaller companies?
Now, I think the argument is that if you have a small company and you only have one driver or you only have two drivers, then they have to do all the work. In
so
this
a small
case,
company can commit negligence, but a big company cannot?
No, I think
it sounds like that's where you hit it.
It's degrees of negligence, Your Honor. And
why is it, if you're driving them too far, why is it any more negligent for a big company to do that than a small company?
I don't think it is. But I think the question
and
is...
It looks to me like the argument is exactly that big companies can afford to be less productive, which, of course, we know they can't be in the long run. They'll go out of business if they do that.
Right.
But that makes the argument just that big companies can afford big verdicts.
No, I think it means that they probably have more resources in order to prevent being negligent.
Well, but that's the point, then. The argument is to tell the jury that they have more resources.
Well, and this is a question that you all asked. Was there evidence about how big the company was?
Right.
And there was. Is part of this presentation unobjected to? The question is, how many drivers do you have? We have 3,000 drivers. Mr. Wright admitted that there's evidence in the record that they had offices in other places.
So there was no need to show the jury that this is not a mom and pop operation.
It was all part of the presentation. It was all part of the submission that
well,
was submitted.
Well, this is a special part. How rich the defendant is a special part. Like how rich the plaintiff is a special part.
Well,
and so we didn't need that part to show this was not a mom and pop operation.
And Your Honor, were I a judge, I might not have admitted this evidence. It might have been error for me to do that.
Right.
But it's an abuse of discretion standard. Did the judge have discretion to decide whether this evidence was relevant or not relevant?
And, of course, we don't give judges that discretion on insurance because we know what will happen if you tell the jury there's insurance.
And that's a good example, Your Honor, because the admission of evidence of insurance is not always reversible error.
Right.
There's no presumed harm in Texas law with regard to these sort of things.
But we don't look for, did you mention insurance? We don't treat it like admission of a hearsay statement. We don't look around to say, did you emphasize insurance? I mean, we look at the verdict and say, did the verdict show that the jury knew there was insurance?
Well, and the question here is, in the admission of evidence, is did the whole judgment turn on this evidence that was admitted? And here we know that it wasn't, that the whole judgment didn't turn on it.
You ever said on insurance, we look and just did the whole judgment turn on insurance?
Yeah.
I mean, surely the judgment turns on the evidence at least a little, even when they find out there's insurance.
But that's why it's so hard to reverse a case on the admission and exclusion of evidence, because you have to show that the evidence was so important that an improper judgment was caused because of that admission or exclusion. We don't look for error-free trials. There's going to be things in the heat of the moment that a judge admits that probably shouldn't be admitted. There's going to be things that the judge excludes that probably shouldn't be excluded. The way we sift that out is to determine whether that error was so significant that it should result in the reversal of the whole judgment. And the way we do that is we look at the entire record. And when we look at the entire record here, this one sentence about annual sales of this company was never referred to by anybody again.
What if the one sentence was to the defendant's race?
Well, of course, this court, there are certain things that are incurable error.
Right.
So that is.
So that's our question, the question presented precisely by this case. Should how rich one of the parties is be one of those questions, like race, that we're just not going to allow?
Never has been. And they haven't cited a single case in the history of Texas jurisprudence where it has been. In every case, in order to determine whether it is reversible error, the court looks to whether it's evidence that the whole case turned upon.
Everybody pretty much knows if you throw in that the defendant's insured, there's going to be a problem affirming that case.
Well, the only way you
even get, if you throw it in just a little.
Well, the only way you get there is to disregard the harmless error rule.
It seems to me,
a good case to reaffirm the harmless error rule.
It seems to me most people are aware that there's insurance involved in some scheme, since the state requires every driver to have insurance and so forth. So perhaps the better review is an abuse of discretion.
Yes, and we have, in this case, with this other evidence of that they had 3,000 employees and that they had other evidence, that makes this cumulative error, so that would be harmless as well. But there's other reasons. In this case, they say, well, we know that this is error because the verdict was inflated. This verdict wasn't inflated. The jury gave far less than was requested of them. In fact, with Michael Sebchik, they only gave him $100,000. With Kathy Loft, they gave her less than was requested in every element damages except for medical. And that, in this case, this is an odd case because this is a very narrow issue presented to this court. There's no challenge to liability here. The driver admitted he was negligent on the stand. There's no challenge to the fact that she's permanently brain injured. She has a traumatic brain injury. Doctors got up on the stand and testified to that it's a permanent injury she will never recover from. There's no dispute in the evidence that she can never work again. They didn't even present any experts at trial. Okay? There's no evidence it's inflated.
Well, that seems to me to highlight the problem here. The fact that your opponent was saying a moment ago that if we allow this type of evidence to come in on a case like this, and here we are arguing about, well, whether it was an abuse of discretion or not, and you don't have a case of gross negligence, it's a lot easier to sustain damages when they're not punitive damages. Those are getting overturned frequently. So the easy way to do this is you just convince a judge on some pretext argument that you should allow this type of inflated worth evidence to come in and never mention it again. Then you can argue, as you're doing here, well, it was never argued, it can't be shown to be harmful error or not, but it's out there in an attempt to inflate the damages. There can be no other explanation for it, it seems to me. So how is this not, if we were to say that there is no showing of abuse of discretion here, why isn't this just a template for future plaintiffs to try to do this?
Well, all evidence will be subject to the harmless error rule. And in other cases in Texas jurisprudence, we've cited them where people have tried to get in evidence of wealth and that sort of thing. They've applied the harmless error rule. In some cases, it's reversible because they relied upon it in argument. They relied upon it in other things. Just the mere statement that they had $1.9 billion in sales doesn't mean the jury is, as Justice Brister stated in the Bed Bath & Beyond case, doesn't mean that the jury is cattle that will be stampeded to an improper verdict. I think that when you look at this verdict, you can see that the jury...
And the thing I'm troubled about in this case, it was the word billion. 190,000, I think I probably agree with you. Maybe even 800,000. But when you say billion,
This is Waller County. I mean, how many billionaires are there probably? How many businesses, maybe Bluebell, but I don't know if they sell $1 billion worth of ice cream. But that's big numbers in Waller County. No matter what word goes in front of it, billion is big.
And I understand that. And Waller County is a bunch of conservative Germans, and I think that's the reason that they didn't give the plaintiff everything the plaintiff was asking for. But you have, in order to get there where you want to get, that they somehow, because of their knowledge about Reliance, you have to assume this assumption that Mr. Rice asked you to assume, that they knew that Reliant was going to be paying this judgment. Reliant wasn't even mentioned in the jury charge as far as who is responsible for paying this damage. It's what sum of money paid now in cash is Samuel Alvarado responsible for paying, not Reliance Steel. So there's a lot of hurdles you have to get to. You have to get to this presumed harm. You have to get to an assumption that the jury knew about Reliance Steel was part of the charge. Reliance Steel is not even mentioned.
The harmless error rule is always hard because we're trying to look back and second guess. And, when you listen to the appellate explanations about what was harmful and what wasn't, they're not always convincing. But I'm wondering, part of that is because the explanation tries to be objective. Try to look at, what happened in the trial and how much was argued. I'm wondering, what's your view on a situation like this where counsel either knows or should know that this evidence is probably not admissible? There's a very strong argument why it should not be admitted. And he tries anyway, not just in the heat of the moment, but in a conference outside the presence of the jury. Everybody's sitting there. The judge has got time to think about it. It seems that trial counsel must have been thinking, this is going to help me if I get this in. To what extent should we take that into account in looking at the harmless error rule, however many years later it's been since the case was tried?
I think that's a lot of supposition, too. And the reason I feel that is because there's nothing in the evidence that would support that. And if he believed that that helped him so much, you would think that he would at least maybe even include it at some point in his argument. And he didn't do that. And I think that's why the harmless error rule is done. But
so
you ask
course,
what I'm sorry.
He got the best of all worlds. He got it in. And like you say, like Justice Brisker said, when you say billion, to most jurors, their ears are just going to prick up. So, fairness to the argument, this is a little different. Good lawyering, probably.
It works the other way as well. Justice Hecht asked me what I would do in that situation, and if I were in the situation of Mr. Wright's client, representing Mr. Wright's client, and I've been in that situation, I try to make sure that this appellate court, knows the harm. If I think that this is going to be significant harm, I'm talking about this harm at every stage I can with this judge. I'm moving for a mistrial. I'm requesting a limiting instruction. I'm doing something. All they did here was make the objection and go on. Nobody ever mentioned this piece of evidence ever again, not the defense, not the plaintiffs, not the judge. This evidence was never referred to again, and we would have to overrule the harmless error rule in order to adopt their argument.
Now, what is the argument that $1.9 billion in gross sales is relevant at all?
Well, the argument is in our brief.
Sales doesn't tell you anything about net worth.
No,
they're entirely different animals.
And the question:
the company could have $1.9 billion in gross sales and $2 billion in costs and be worthless, or it could be very valuable. Gross sales tells you absolutely nothing in this context about the entity. Why? What's the argument that it's relevant in this type of a case?
Yeah, I think the question was asked. And this is the question and answer. How big is your company? And the guy says, I think we did $1.9 billion in annual sales last year, or in 2002. And so it's like, I agree with you. I don't think that that really tells you anything about the net worth of the company, but it certainly tells you something about the resources that they have available to them, how big the company is.
Perhaps, but I mean, you could have sales that are based on passive income, contractor relationships, and investment income. It doesn't tell you. Now, saying 3,000 employees may tell you something, or offices in 20 states, and you still have to wonder about the relevance there, but telling billions of dollars of sales seems to me to have very little, if any, connection to relevance when the facts of the case are like these.
And relevance is where the evidence has any tendency to make a fact more or less probable. And in this situation, the fact that he was trying to make more probable is that they had plenty of resources, and therefore they shouldn't have done this. And that's what he was trying to establish, the plaintiff attorney was trying to establish. As I say, if I were the judge, I may have said that doesn't come in. You can get the stuff in about the drivers, but I don't want anything to do with financial information. But that's a discretionary judgment call. And the way we measure that discretion is by, you know, looking at the whether there's any relevance, and if we find that there's error, whether it's reversible error.
Well, as to the discretionary judgment call, I guess the argument was that this company had the resources to have additional drivers so that they wouldn't be fatigued and cause this type of accident.
That's how I understand it.
So doesn't that suggest a different negligence standard for a small trucking company versus a large trucking company? If a small trucking company doesn't have the resources to have any more than one driver, in the argument then that was proposed at trial to the judge that the negligence standard will be different because a driver in a big company is held to a higher standard than a driver in a little company.
I think that's true as a fact. I mean, I think that's what reality is, and you're looking at what a reasonable person in the situation of this company would do, and so you have to see what the situation of that company is in order to determine what negligence is.
We may be missing each other a little bit. A driver on a truck on the highway has a standard of care to satisfy, regardless of whether they come from a big company or a little company.
I agree
right?
with that, just wondering.
And whether there's somebody else back in the office to spell them after a day or two or not doesn't change that standard of care on the highway when that guy's behind the wheel.
No question about it.
If it does, I'm going to start looking at company labels when I'm driving and changing lanes.
No question about it. I agree with you.
So the argument that additional resources to spell drivers plays into the standard of care, again, I'm finding it hard to see how that's even a defensible statement as to the standard of care for that driver on the highway.
And you may find, Your Honor, that it was error to admit that evidence. But I think we're beyond that, because what Mr. Wright's client wants you to do is to overrule the harmless error rule. And you can't do that in this instance, because this is an instance where
assume we don't want to reverse every case where there's a mistake in it. Let's assume we're going to do. But there's some things, like race, that we want the message to be clear to everybody. Never, never. And the way we do that is by saying we're not going to look at harmless error for this. If you do that, you're doing it over. We don't want to do that on all the hearsay rules and everything else in the rules of evidence. But this, we don't want a system where people say, forget about who did anything wrong. These people have money, and my client is brain damaged, and she needs it. Now, how do we tell people, don't do that, and make sure that they don't?
Well, I think if you want to create a fundamental error in Texas, or incurable error, you can do that. You are the Supreme Court. You can do that. But I'm telling you that
Mr. Wright says all we need to do is presumed error. That if this is clear enough, defense attorneys, plaintiff attorneys, whoever knows they shouldn't do this, and if they walk into it deliberately, then they're going to have, rather than the other side having to prove something went wrong, they're going to have to prove to us why it couldn't have made any difference in their case.
As Your Honor knows, the incurable error doctrine has had a sorry history in Texas jurisprudence. What is incurable for one person may not be incurable for others.
I agree with that.
And so, you know, you would be going down the wrong road if you wanted to create some kind of category, because you could never make it precise enough so that it would apply in every instance. You know, you have a situation where the discretion of the court is at play and should be at play.
Counsel, on damages, just a moment. We require pretty stringent proof of past damages, property damage, medical damage, things of that nature. What about future medical? Shouldn't we at least look for something solid other than just allowing the jury to say, well, I think it ought to be about $200,000? I mean, aren't those completely different standards, and should they be?
Yes, Ron, I see my time is almost up. May I have a moment to respond?
That's up to the Chief.
May I have a moment
to respond? Please
respond. The Reliant Steel has argued that these damages were liquidated in the future. Future damages are never liquidated. They are always uncertain. They are uncertain because we don't know what the rising costs of medical care are. We don't know what inflation is going to do. We don't know what new treatments are going to be available. That's why the jury is not bound by expert testimony with regard to future medical. With regard to future lost earning capacity, we're only talking about the capacity that is lost. How do you measure that in the future? We don't know if the person will ever get a job because they will never get a job.
They're impaired.
They can never work again.
And I agree with you. So do we just allow a jury to fill in a blank?
No. McIver versus Gloria is the case you need to look at because that's the case that set this standard. And it says that each case is judged on its own facts and that damages are proved to the extent they are susceptible of determination within this case. You don't manufacture evidence to create it. You use what evidence you have to try and establish what the loss of earning capacity was and what the loss medical was.
And then we just let the jury fill in the blank.
And, you know, when there's a complex injury, like in the case of a brain injury, when there's complex injury, I believe that the jury should have more discretion because I can't imagine any more complex injury than brain damage. And therefore, I think that we are in the realm of letting the jury decide what the proper evidence of damages are, provided that they're provided with some evidence to support some measure of damages, and they don't just pick a number out of thin air.
Other questions?
One other question, Chief, if I may. As to past medicals, the Court of Appeals said that there was legally and factually sufficient evidence of $33,985.23 of past medicals. The jury came back with $40,000 for past medicals. Is the amount of past medicals in this record established as a matter of law?
I believe it is, and here's why.
At $33,982.
No, there was no evidence to controvert it, number one. But number two, on their argument in the Court of Appeals, Reliant Steel's argument in the Court of Appeals was they proved only $33,982. They didn't prove $40,000. They proved only $33,982. And therefore, you should reverse and remand because they presented some evidence, but they didn't present the evidence of $40,000. Now, we argued.
If that was the only issue in the case, what remedy would you ask?
Well, the Court of Appeals did the right thing by if they believe that we didn't provide evidence that would support $40,000, we argued it should. But if they believe that the evidence was only that $33,982, then the Court of Appeals did the proper thing by reforming the judgment down to what the evidence was that was proved, as stated by them in their briefs.
And proven by as a matter of law.
And that, as they said, it's legally sufficient evidence and factually sufficient evidence. The court has discretion under Rule 43 to reduce the amount of damages to the amount that is proven by the evidence.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hall.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. McMains will present the rebuttal for the petitioners.
Mr. McVeigh, if wealth is such a concern to anybody, and maybe it skunks the box like insurance does, why don't we just eliminate all corporate defendants from the pleadings and put the employee up there so that the jury will be totally unaware that there's a corporation behind the negligence acts of its employees?
And, well, I mean, there was never any effort, obviously, to do that. That's not, we're not contending that there's no evidence that a corporation, there are plenty of poor corporations in the country.
And there are plenty of mom-and-pop stores like Sam Walmart and his family.
Correct. But it was, the course and scope was stipulated in this case. There was not even a pleading of negligence on the part of the company with regards to driving the drivers too long. The only pleadings of negligence with regards to the negligent conduct of the driver himself, not of the company. Those are the only that's the only cause of action that's even asserted. There are allegations that were found basically on appeal about causation that are buried in the pleadings, but they aren't the basis of any negligence claim against Reliance. The company knows that they represent Reliance. They've known it from the time that there was voir dire. They knew it from the from not only the caption in the case, probably knew it from on the basis of the argument and the fact that that's what the evidence is.
You said the company. You mean the jury knows?
Jury knows, yes, right. Sure.
Then why isn't it harmless error for this one-sentence statement to come in if it's already known that there's
once again, because it's wealth evidence, and because it's wealth evidence that this court initially in Transport versus Morrell took posture of saying that the reason we have a bifurcated proceeding,
I understand that. There are cases
is precisely cases, to avoid this wealth evidence.
There are cases where insurance is invoked in a trial court, and those cases aren't always reversed.
Correct, but they also aren't always embodied by statute, which is true in this case.
What about Mr. Holman's point that the admission at trial, if it were such a big deal, then you would have made it a bigger deal. You would have asked for a limiting instruction.
Okay. Fact of the matter is this.
Mistrial.
In the first place, when you have an objection overruled, you have no requirement to go any further in order to preserve any complaint. There is no preservation issue there or makeable. Secondly, to continue to request relief before the jury does nothing but emphasize the problem, and that doesn't help you in the least. But the point is that there is no kind of requirement that you have to have a request for an instruction. Once you have had an objection overruled, you only make go further with regards to requests for instructions, and there is even basically authority that you never have to ask for a mistrial as being a prerequisite for reversible error. But even with regards to that, I've always operated under the assumption, and my old school evidence and procedure prof, Dean Blakely, told me that you keep going until the court denies you the relief, and you can stop then. If he's denied you the relief, you preserved it. And that's exactly what happened in this case because the objection was overruled. Once it's overruled, it's in the record in the case for the jury to consider it for whatever purposes they want to, and we think they considered it for illicit purposes. There's no other explanation. The argument about the fact that the suggestion that Ms. Loth has permanent injuries, she didn't seek medical attention for 2.5 years, number one. With regards to this idea that the medical was past medical is established as a matter of law, it's 2.5 years after the accident before any of that medical is incurred, incidentally. Secondly, the neurologist that testified in that case said that he couldn't say that any of her condition was permanent. Third, there was competing psychological testimony that she had done average on other psychological tests and there was no problems. The need for medication shows she had headaches once or twice a month. And with regards to the need to take medication, their evidence that they tried to put up on the board and that they tried to get an award for is $37,000. She got $15,000 in past loss earnings for 3.5 years. For 23 years, if you take the long side of their argument and their expert, she got $750,000 in future lost earning capacity.
Mr. McMaines, how do we draw
500% more.
How do we draw a line here? If $1.9 billion is too much, where do we say it's
not that, Your Honor. My belief is, and I believe that it is not a question of overruling the harmless error rule. It is the fact that when this court, initially in Morrell, and the legislature subsequently in Chapter 41 says, this evidence is so pernicious it should not be admitted in the liability phase of the trial, period, at the election of the defendant. Should not be admitted at all. When you have a statutory directive to that effect that is violated for the precise reason of showing wealth, when there is no claim of gross ever going to be made and no claim of primary liability that would justify the admission of the evidence, we think that's sufficient.
It's a matter of intent.
Well, it's a matter of intent coupled with the fact that it's legislatively prescribed that we think supplies a legitimate basis for suggesting that there is greater harm in this case.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, the cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.